This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Okay, guys, we'll get started. Good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. And next week, Wednesday the 6th of August, is the 250th anniversary of the birth of Daniel O'Connell. So to mark the occasion, it is entirely appropriate that this afternoon's HedgeGhoul is coming to you live from the Glasnevin Visitor Centre in the shadow. You can't actually see it, damn it. In the shadow of his mausoleum, the centrepiece of the cemetery that he founded in 1832. So to reassess the Liberator, I'm joined by, on my right, Professor Patrick Gagan, Director of Trinity Longroom Hub and presenter of News Talk's Talkin' History. And to his right, Jennifer T. Keating, teaching professor in the Department of English at the University of Pittsburgh. And on my left, Professor Christine Keneally, founding director of Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac, University. And then finally, to Christine's left, David Matzi, professor of English language translation and linguistics at the University of Modena and Reggio Emilia. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by Trinity College Dublin as part of its two-day O'Connell 250 Symposium, Liberty, Democracy and the Struggle for Human Rights. Okay, Patrick, to get us started, talk to us about O'Connell's family background. So as I understand it, they were kind of minor Gaelic gentry or gentry with a Gaelic background. Now, this is in the 18th century, in the penal era, penal law. So how did such a family manage to survive? I mean, they were subject to two confiscations, as I understand it, yet they managed to kind of cling on.
Yes, there was definitely some money in the family, but really through O'Connell's uncle, Hunting Cap, who had his finger in everything, including a bit of smuggling. And but O'Connell's own family home was incredibly modest if you ever pass by it or visit it. And, you know, nowadays, if O'Connell was a 21st century political figure, he'd play up his humble origins and how he was a self-made man. But back then, O'Connell was furious if biographers, historians, or journalists talked about his humble backgrounds. He said, no, I come from one of the finest families in all of Ireland, and we go back centuries. So he very much wanted to project that image that it was this great Gaelic family. But, you know, some of that money came through smuggling, and in the early 1780s, O'Connell's uncle and father were arrested, and it looked like there'd be a big prosecution. And so there was no real legal certainty and no great security with the income.
Yeah, but let's just focus in on this, right? Because as I understand it, that because they were caught in flagrante delicto, right, on the beach with the contraband, and I think then, you see, up to this point, he'd relied on a kind of a class solidarity with his Protestant neighbours, right? But I think some of the locals took direct action. Anyway, the whole thing escalated, and there were calls for the trial to move to Dublin. And that would have meant a death sentence, probably, for somebody in their position.
I know, it was hugely significant. And O'Connell would have been 7, 8 years old, and, you know, there's stories told about it. And, you know, this was a time when O'Connell was becoming kind of politically aware. He, 1782, with Legislative Independence, and Henry Grattan became his great hero. So at a time when he was becoming aware of how the world worked and how Ireland worked, he was also becoming aware that his own family security wasn't actually very secure.
No, but for them, like, the law was the enemy.
Yes, and even the name Hunting Cap, it's because he refused to wear the beaver cap that they all wore because there was a tax on that. So he wouldn't wear the tax, so he wore this hunting cap. It'd be the equivalent now of wearing a baseball cap. So he's this gentry figure, but he's wearing a baseball cap around, and everyone calls him Baseball Cap because it's so incongruous that here we have this well-off person but going around dressed like that because he refuses to pay the tax on a respectable piece of headwear.
Now, some of O'Connell's kind of left-wing critics would make the point that, you know, he's gentry, you know, he's the upper end of society. But that's precisely because he's Catholic gentry, he's precisely the people targeted by the penal laws. Like, so it makes him more of a target.
Yeah, and also, you know, the money is all at the discretion of his uncle. So his uncle at various times took O'Connell in, you know, kind of kicked him out, made him his heir, disinherited him, tried to demand who he would marry, would disinherit him then again when he married his own preference. And I do think children are spoilt when they know that there's a trust fund coming. You know, if you know that there's a large sum of money coming when a relative dies, you know, there isn't really an incentive to save. And that was exactly, it ruined Daniel, because all he had to do was wait for Huntingcap to die and he would inherit Derry Nan and, you know, have access to all of this and the money. But he wasn't to calculate that Huntingcap would live to the age of 97. And Daniel was 50 years old before he inherited. So by that time, he was hugely in debt, because from an early age, probably around 15, 16, he was just getting into debt with money because he always thought he'd have this great fallback.
OK, I want to bring in Jennifer and David here, because we painted a picture here of somebody coming from a legally insecure background. Did this give him a certain empathy with the excluded in society? Maybe Jennifer, if you want to comment on that, because his advocacy, you know, his abolitionism, his promotion of Jewish rights and so on.
Yeah, I think his background and his consciousness of the ways in which the Catholic population was put in a subjugated position within the legal structure really colored his perception of others who also might have been put in the same kinds of legal categories. And I think it really helped to situate the way that he positioned himself, certainly as a barrister, but also thinking about the leverage that he would decide to strategically push on when he was developing as a politician. So I think that consciousness of identification of the human in those who he wished to represent, who he wished to learn from and agitate on his own behalf, as well as in the strategic mobilization of his movement, all came from that position that he held and was conscious of early in his life, even though he did have considerable advantage, of course, in comparison to the population that he was working with.
David, do you want to comment on this?
I do agree with Jennifer, absolutely. This would have informed O'Connell's own mindset in relation to slavery. Mind you, when he was elected as an MP, he was slightly frustrated that the Speaker of the House was deliberately avoiding his eye. He did not speak as often as he wanted to. But he was pretty active in relation to slavery. So on the 6th of April 1830, he established the Society of Friends of Ireland of all religious persuasions, calling for an abolition of slavery across the British colonies. In 1835, he was appointed Honorary Correspondent Secretary of the Glasgow Emancipation Society. And he would very often bring up slavery when he addressed various audiences in public. For instance, he once aggressively asked an audience, "Are we to be called slaves?" And then he reminded them of the 80,000 Irish people or so who were sent to Barbados as slaves under Oliver Cromwell. Patrick Gagan, in his wonderful book, The Liberator, tells us a story about O'Connell attending an anti-slavery meeting in London. And upon being recognised, apparently he was ushered to the front. And he began to rally against Americans essentially pursuing double standards, boasting of the principles embodied by the Declarations of Independence, but at the same time countenancing the existence of slavery, particularly in the south of the United States. And then controversially, he brought Ireland into the meeting by comparing the Irish to slaves. And so, essentially, he was very vocal about the abolition of slavery. He believed in human dignity and the fundamental rights associated with human dignity. He believed that no matter where people were from, no matter what their background might have been, their full potential would only ever be unlocked if they were free. And this let's not forget this, to put things into context very briefly, that whenever he spoke out against slavery, for instance, in the United States, the kind of environment in which he did so was pretty challenging, because criticizing slavery might have compromised vital and welcome support from the United States to the repeal movement in financial terms. And some people were hostile to the anti-slavery message because they believed that this was actually a British conspiracy to undermine the American Union. And many people in the United States, people who would also might have been amenable to the idea of abolishing slavery, they harbored fears in relation to the status of and competition from freed slaves in the near future.
I tell you, I want to just go back, I'm going to come back to the question of slavery later in this discussion. Patty, just back to you again in terms of his background, right? Like, was Daniel O'Connell familiar with the lives of the masses, right? I mean, or was he detached from them? He was fostered out until he was four with a local family.
Yeah, so he would have been following in that, his family would have been following in that great Gaelic tradition. And so he was definitely of the people. He knew the people, he was fluent in Irish, he knew what it was like. But he also had a certain kind of remove as well, because he very from an early age saw himself as someone who had this great destiny and that he would be this chieftain. So he always lived beyond his means and, you know, bought the house in Merrion Square, even though they didn't have the money for it, because he wanted to be the first Catholic moving in there and showing he had the great carriage. And he had, when he even inherited Derry Nan, it wasn't great enough for him. So he had to buy furniture that used to belong to the old Lord Chancellor. And he went further into debt, doing up Derry Nan, so it was a home worthy of a chieftain who, and that would impress people who visited. So, yeah, so at one part he was very much connected to the soil and connected to the people, but on the other, he was someone who saw himself as having this great destiny and that he was to be their leader.
Okay, let's look to flip that around, right? How was he regarded by the masses? And I'm thinking here about folklore, right? And you know that brilliant project done in the 30s and 40s. Apparently, Daniel O'Connell is number one. Oliver Cromwell is number two, as people most cited in the folklore. What type of things, what kind of folklore was there? Like, what was he alleged to have done?
Well, there'd be all kinds of things, like mythological things, a bit like Davy Crockett in the United States, and, you know, stories of plots to assassinate him, and he might be in London and his soup would be poisoned, but the serving girl was Irish and she would warn him, Osquelga, and then he'd know to avoid it. You know, all these kind of fantastical plots. Stories about his relationships with women, and one of them was Daniel O'Connell's great big steam engine. He makes babies by steam, and he was very much this, you know, and again, it was that kind of chieftain, Gaelic kind of leader going back centuries, that he was someone who, yeah, so he appears in it in kind of both realistic and in fantastical ways.
And I mean, I think I remember the stories of how Dan outwits his opponents. Oh, it's all about his
outwitting and the legal cases. So they're not like the legal cases where he's using the law to win the case. It's all about he's able to destroy someone in the... So it's more like TV law cases where you don't need to know any law. You just need to use your wits and you'll win the case. So much of the folklore is about that. Whereas, of course, you know, you're never going to be a great lawyer if you're just relying on that. Like O'Connell's great skill was that he knew the law backwards. And then if that wasn't working out for him, then he would try something
else. Yeah, but he did seem to have, you know, an understanding of kind of popular mood, because his big strength was appealing to juries rather than legal detail.
Oh, no, you're right. He could connect to juries. He could connect with audiences. And he might start a speech and he would notice very early on that it wasn't working. So he would immediately recalibrate and he might make it a little bit more coarse, or he might make it a little bit more sophisticated, or he might tell a few jokes just to warm up the crowd. And so he was incredible at gauging kind of the reaction. But then, you know, growing up, you know, he had the nickname Father Dan, so even for many years afterwards, because according to one local tradition, he was destined for the priesthood. And that's something that you have to remember, that when he was born 250 years ago in 1775, legally he couldn't become a barrister. you know, so many of the profession were closed off. So he was either going to become a farmer or a smuggler or a lawyer in a different country or the priesthood. So the belief was that he was destined for the priesthood.
Just something before I forget it, because I forgot to write it down here, is his physical stature. I mean, he was a big man.
He was a big,
robust,
a big man, robust man. I always thought, and I think we're wrong to picture him as the O'Connell of the statue, because that's the later O'Connell. And O'Connell, in his letters to his wife, talked about putting on weight from about 1829 on, and he says, oh, I'm getting a bit stout. But up until then, the age of about 55, he was tall, he was lean, and I think people, that was always commented on, that people like to look up to a leader who was tall and physically imposing. And I always thought, if we were casting an ideal movie version of O'Connell, Michael Fassbender as the young O'Connell, because it was that tall, muscular frame. Fassbender is half Kerry, half German. You know, O'Connell was, you know, full Kerry, but educated in France, and pronounced some words in a French accent. So, but it was that kind of tall, muscular frame, but not the, we tend to read back the frame from the later years into his early life. But actually, you know, for most of his life, he looked very different.
And of course, he was bald, even though he's always depicted with a full head of hair.
Yeah, the bald thing, I got into a huge controversy about 10 years ago about the baldness. I'm not sure about the baldness. Anyway, the baldness is a whole other controversy.
Well, I mean, it's a story I've been telling my walking tours for years. Correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, that somebody was ribbing him, one of his opponents in the House of Commons about you know, the fact he was wearing a wig. And O'Connell then jumps up, takes off the wig. Yes, I'm bald, but I've grown bald in the cause of Ireland. And you know. So, OK, I want to just change tack here, Christine, bring you in here, right? The point is that he was a landlord, right? I mean, what was his record as a landlord? I mean, did he have any empathy with his tenants, or is this just kind of romantic nonsense?
Yeah, he was a pretty good landlord. In some ways, we could say he was an absentee, but not absentee in the sense of not caring about people who lived on his estates. He certainly did. He, for the most part, left one of his sons, Morris, in charge. And in terms of the famine, he and Morris, they communicated a lot. Obviously, O'Connell was not always in Derrynane, and he immediately insisted, please lower the rents, please don't feed the dogs if it means there's no food for my tenants. He opened soup kitchens, so they did a whole range of things for his tenants. But the London Times, one of the many English newspapers that really hated him, they sent a commissioner to Ireland, 1845, 1846, the so-called Special Commissioner. And the Special Commissioner really wanted to do a hatchet job on O'Connell in particular. And he wrote back saying he is a very bad landlord, his tenants don't like him. And this was reprinted in many, many newspapers. Of course, O'Connell was furious and called him a liar, scum, etc., etc. But unfortunately, people did believe that lie about O'Connell. But in fact, as we've heard, he was somebody who had a lot of empathy with people who were poorer than him.
So, I know, just did he have any idea of the structure of economics, right? I mean, it's all very well, you know, opening soup kitchens and so on. I mean, did he have any grasp of the structural problems that Ireland faced?
In terms of the famine generally
and the poverty of the mass of people and so forth.
Absolutely. So he became involved in the famine. It wasn't a famine at that stage, that's retrospective. But in October 1845, when the potato first failed, he joined Dublin Corporation. They actually appointed a fact-finding committee to find out the extent of the blight and to try and find out what caused the blight. Of course, nobody knew at that stage what caused the blight. But he became convinced that this was just the start of what would develop into a famine. So they formed themselves into the Mansion House Committee, because the Lord Mayor of Dublin was involved. Mansion House Committee had first been formed in the famine of 1831, and it was formed many other times during the century. But O'Connell was one of the founders in 1845, and they decided that this, the calamity that was coming, needed something structural, that it shouldn't just be done at the local level. So they made an appointment with the Lord Lieutenant, Lord Heytesbury. They met him, and he was very unsympathetic. But the things they were suggesting were really innovative and would have been effective. So taxes on food leaving the country, taxes on making food coming into the country, tax-free, tax on absentee landlord. And this had been done before. All these things had been done before, stopping the distillation of all sorts of grain, because Ireland was a massive exporter of grain, corn, wheat, barley, and also, as you all know, a massive exporter of what was called porter, Guinness, and of whiskey. And none of those things were done. And because the Lord Lieutenant refused to do anything, O'Connell then took it to the Prime Minister in London, who also promised to do something, but as we all know, did very little, especially when Lord John Russell came into power. So at that point, O'Connell was despairing and felt even though structural changes were needed, something had to be done in the immediate sense of doing something now, rather than depend on the government, because that help was not coming.
So you, I mean, you reckon that his record on the family is quite good then? I mean,
absolutely.
Because I think there would be the impression that it completely fazed him, that he had no answers to the problem.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And I think we have set in context, this is 1845, O'Connell is getting on, but we know he was ill. He actually hadn't been to Parliament for a few years, but because he was so desperate, he returned to Parliament and made many, many speeches, most of them relating to the famine in Ireland. And his very final speech in Parliament, 8th of February, 1847. At that stage, he was so ill, people could hardly hear him speak, and people were shocked by how much he changed. He was on his way to Italy at that point. And he referred to the famine, said, unless you, the government, come to the help of my people, 25% of them will perish. And he was absolutely right. So he had a very good understanding of what was going on. And from the very outset, he was involved, he was committed.
Now, I want to go back to Patrick, just in terms of O'Connell's political formation, right? Because he would have been in his 20s in the 1790s, you know, the period of the United Irishmen and so on. And I mean, the popular notion is that he was in France, witnessed the excesses of the terror, and that made him a, you know, pacifist the rest of his life. Now, that, I'm always a bit suspicious of this, right? Because it seems like a rationalisation after the fact. I mean, how radical was he in his youth? Because he did flirt with deism.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think, again, we tend to read back the O'Connell from the 1840s and assume that he was like that throughout every decade of his career. In the 1790s, he left revolutionary France very much a conservative, opposed to that mob violence. But then he arrived in Britain and found it to be a very repressive state, and that made him a radical again. And then he came to Ireland. He joined the United Irishmen.
Okay, let's repeat that. Was he in the United Irishmen?
He joined the United Irishmen, and by his own admission, it's not that we're he admitted it. He talked about it himself in later years.
There's this pages torn out of a diary or something. I have a vague
recollection. Well, he feared that he feared that he'd be arrested, so he tore pages out of his diary and he fled Dublin.
As you would at that time in
May 1798. Yeah. But then 1798 turned him against. What he saw as uncontrolled violence, but he also felt that the Irish Catholics had been led astray by leaders who had encouraged them to rise up and had then kind of abandoned them and left the civilian population to bear the brunt of the atrocities. So he became very suspicious of people who tried to ensnare the people into rebellion, because he thought they didn't really care about the people. They only cared about their own ambitions, and it was the people who suffered. But in those earlier decades, he was quite, you know, aggressive, violent in his language, killed a man in his duel in 1815, tried to fight Robert Peel in a follow-up duel, lost his faith, his Catholic faith. So he campaigned for emancipation for 30 years. But for 20 of those years, he wasn't a practicing Catholic. He believed in a God, but wasn't going to mass and wasn't religious. But he was still fighting for the cause, because it was about more than some religious principle. It was about civil and political rights for all Irish Catholics. And he wasn't going to betray his heritage and the people around him. And then the faith returned after the killing of D'Estaire. And then as time went on, he became increasingly devout and religious. But the O'Connell of the 1840s is a very different person from the O'Connell of the 1790s.
I want to bring Jennifer in here, because, I mean, the French Revolution, the United Irishmen, all creatures of the Enlightenment, right? Is Daniel O'Connell a creature of the Enlightenment?
I mean, I think it would be difficult to centralize that, but I think if you look to the language that he employs in the context of his oration and the ways in which he identifies the humanity in populations across the world and agitates for that insistence on humanity, I think those are features certainly that echo principles and values of the Enlightenment. He was also a parliamentarian, and I think his willingness to work within the structure of the parliament, the willingness to then use that leverage in the agitation for the repeal of union are also really interesting ways in which argumentation, acknowledgement of features of humanity, and you see further exploits in that effort in the abolitionist work that he does, continues to offer his own fashioning, right, of what it means to espouse certain features of those principles associated with the Enlightenment, but certainly within the context of the chieftain or other ways in which it's both an adoption of those principles, but then translating them within the features of his own relationship to Ireland. And I think that that particular fashioning and shaping is something that also makes O'Connell incredibly powerful and potent to other figures like Frederick Douglass.
But is he a chameleon-like figure politically? Because on the one hand, he's you know, seen as a conservative Catholic. On the other hand, he's seen as a liberal. Mm. He advocated separation of church and state, in fact. You know, whereas you know the kind of popular misconception is he was just a straight down the line conservative Catholic, etc., etc. So, like he's a bag of contradictions, basically. Or is he? Is there any consistency?
Is it a contradiction to evolve and emerge as a person?
Mm.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that O'Connell offers is the emergence and the evolution of a mind of an evolving barrister who takes the features of his highly successful and incredibly courageous and focused work as a barrister and translating that to the political environment and then responding to the ways in which that political context continues to shift, right? So, Christine, you point to the ways in which he is bringing forward conversations in Parliament to attend to an emerging hunger that are not necessarily brand new, but are appropriation and reappropriation of that power in a political context that's continuing to change. Ireland changes tremendously in the course of his lifetime. The relationships across the Atlantic continue to evolve and change, as well as on continental Europe. And I think to expect any individual, especially a courageous and intelligent person, to continue to steadfastly adhere to the same principles or practices over the course of a lifetime is unfair.
Okay. So he evolves, like his positions change.
I think he's a very sophisticated thinker and practitioner in a space that is incredibly complex, evolving, and requires new tactics every day. But I do think his steadfast support of the abolitionist movement on the terms that he chooses is an indication of courage, clarity of thinking, compassion, and a legacy that offers us an interesting example today.
Now, Christine, and maybe bring in, Christine, this question of his pacifism, right? And, I mean, one of the great quotes you hear about Daniel O'Connell is he said that the freedom of Ireland wasn't worth the shedding of a single drop of blood. Now, is this like a play it again, Sam, thing? Did he actually say this? Some, you know, De Valera saying Labour can wait, you know, these quotes?
He does say it at some point in the 1840s, but I don't see him as a pacifist. I think pacifism is a very noble cause. I think it takes an incredible amount of courage, and I think it's you know, there have been some incredible pacifists throughout history. O'Connell wasn't a pacifist. He was against mob violence. He was against an armed uprising that he believed had no chance of succeeding and would result in huge amounts of suffering. But he did speak during the Monster meetings about what would happen in the event of Ireland ever being invaded. So say Ireland's got her parliament, and say a country, not even, I'm not talking even about Britain, but say a foreign country invaded Ireland. From everything he says in 1843, I don't think he would have any hesitation in saying, we will fight this invader. So he's not a pacifist, but he is against what he thinks are reckless attempts at leading rebellions, which are foolhardy and which will result. At one point, a German visitor to Derrynane asks him, if I offered you the chance of a rebellion and a guaranteed promise that it would succeed, would you go for it? And he kind of refuses to answer it. He says, I'm almost afraid to consider that, which is interesting.
Well, that's like almost a Catholic theological position. I think Thomas Aquinas, you know, that if the violence has no chance of succeeding, then it's not moral. But if it does have a chance, it might be moral, right?
Well, but also in terms of what are going to be the casualties. And for 1798, you know so well the 1798 figures and the bloodshed there and the huge imbalance between the casualties on the Irish side and on the British side and the numbers of civilians killed. And in his mind, you know, you are betraying the Irish people if you organise a rebellion like that. That is going to result in tens of thousands of people massacred.
Christine, can I throw that question to you? I mean, what was he, a sorcerer's apprentice, you know, conjuring up forces that he could not control?
Can you think of an example?
Well, I mean, in terms of these you know, monster meetings, like where he's using this very violent rhetoric, you know, and the point is, like, you've a tide war in the middle of all this, like where scores of people were killed, and I'm pretty sure a lot of them would have been inspired by O'Connell's rhetoric, purely.
Yeah, I think that would be hard to actually link and to prove. But I think for the most part, he did an amazing job in terms of creating so-called monster meetings, not the word he chose, bringing people together, maybe 500,000 people, and they were peaceful. And that is incredible. So I don't think he really unleashed forces he couldn't control. The tithe war, it ended successfully. So again, something he did control. But just going back to your previous question, I think he was an ultimate pragmatist. He was great at the art of the deal, if I can use that phrase. And he knew when he should compromise, he knew when he should give in, he knew when he should change. So I think he's pragmatic as well as being child of the Enlightenment. And coming back to that, I absolutely think he was a child of the Enlightenment in terms of he was a human rights advocate. And I think that's what really marks him out and distinguishes him above everybody else of his generation. So in that sense, he was brilliant. But again, a man of contradictions. You probably know he loved Queen Victoria. Mm. And she was quite entranced with him. When she was 18 years old, she wrote in her diary, "The person I most want to meet is Daniel O'Connell." Mm. And he just happened to be at some function that night, so she met him. And she noted his eyes were blue and twinkly, but she felt he was devious. So, he definitely, and we talked about, and I've talked about women who came to the anti-slavery meeting in 1840. There was a vote, should women be allowed to be delegates at an anti-slavery meeting? Of course, the vote was no, they shouldn't. And O'Connell voted to exclude the women. They challenged him, and he publicly apologised and said he was wrong. And for the 4 days of that convention, every day he sat with the women, and they also found him delightful. Definitely, he was charismatic in many ways. But I think he was pragmatic, and I think he would not deliberately have sacrificed any of his followers. Again, the point, he didn't want bloodshed when he felt it was needless. But also on that point, he sent his 14-year-old son to South America to fight with Simon Bolivar. So he's a man of contradictions.
I'm getting nowhere on this question of the violence of his rhetoric. David, help me out here, right? I mean, was his rhetoric, was it or was it not violent? I mean, some of the stuff he comes out with, you know, I mean, my question is, was he a Democrat or was he a demagogue?
Well, perhaps there is an element of both in Daniel O'Connell. Well, certainly there was something flamboyant about his performances in public, and his language could be quite aggressive, quite inveterate at times. He is reported to have referred to a young Robert Peel as a scented fop. He once referred to the Duke of Wellington as a stunted corporal, and he even described British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli as the heir at law of that blasphemous thief dying upon the cross, which is, you know, taking things very far, I should say. And certainly he was a great performer in court as well. A case that is often cited is the McGee case of 1813. Now, that was a very complicated case because John McGee from the Dublin Evening Post had essentially been targeted by the then Chief Secretary of Ireland, Robert Peel, not as a Catholic, that was a bit sophisticated, but as a Protestant who was sympathetic to the Catholic cause. And so he was charged with publishing a libel against the Duke of Richmond, and before a jury that was packed with Orangemen, he stood very little chances of being acquitted. And O'Connell must have been acutely aware of this. And so what did he do? Well, to cut a long story short, he turned the courtroom into a political platform. And he rallied against the Attorney General, William Saurin, a man that he particularly disliked. And truth be told, Saurin was a very arrogant man, ill-prepared for the case. And he was rabidly anti-Catholic. And so O'Connell began by accusing him of being, quote, a profligate liar. Now, you don't easily accuse an Attorney General of being a liar, of course. And he then accused Saurin of mixing his personal political beliefs with his brief as the Attorney General. For what is it, he wondered, that Catholics wish? Nothing, he said, but to partake in the advantages of the Constitution. So he postured as a man of the law, as opposed to somebody who was, in fact, abusing the law. And then he spoke for more than 2 hours, something that Robert Peel resented when he heard of it, exposing what he saw as the vulgarity of Saurin. He said, "Gentlemen of the court, the Attorney General has referred to my client as a malefactor, a Jacobin, a brothel keeper," he then said, "a ruffian," and that was unstoppable. Now, this didn't win the case, but the speech proved rhetorically very successful. No less than 100,000 copies of the speech were printed and distributed across Ireland. The speech was translated into French and distributed across France. That's how clever he was. And sometimes he was prone to a certain amount of rhetorical trickery, as it were. He often argued about values. Now, arguing about values, arguing that something is a value and as such it should be treasured, is very tricky business. Because when you talk to large audiences, you may be talking to people who hold different views, different beliefs, and who are committed to very different value systems. But he used a tactic that was incredibly clever. He essentially argued that if the British government conceded repeal, if the British government allowed the Irish to reinstate a parliament in Dublin, this would result in cementing Ireland's committed relationship with Britain. So the idea is, if you grant repeal, you will ultimately benefit from it. So one value to the Irish, repeal, essentially included and underpinned another that was very palatable to the British political establishment. Very clever way of going about things. But was he also a Democrat? I believe he definitely was. He was genuinely committed to democracy. And, I mean, take for instance, the meetings of the Repeal Association at the Corn Exchange building on Burke Quay in Dublin. Now, this was a hugely successful experiment with alternative democracy. It was a way of showing the Irish themselves, first and foremost, but the rest of Europe and Britain, of course, that the Irish were perfectly capable of discussing matters constructively and openly, that they would discuss matters while at the same time preserving social order, abiding by the law, respecting private property. It was, let's say, a first experiment in self-government, which was to be very influential in the decades to come. And so, essentially, this kind of experiment, and by the way, the idea that O'Connell entertained that the Irish should also run their own judicial affairs was extremely influential during the War of Independence of 1919 to 1921, when Republican courts operated across Ireland. And ultimately, as a Democrat, one of the ideas that O'Connell most forcefully pressed, in my opinion, was the view that so much could be achieved through compromise. And that's an idea that proved influential for the likes of Charles Parnell when he spearheaded the Irish Parliamentary Party in the mid-1880s, and to a whole generation of men like Arthur Griffith, who, by using the same methods and negotiating the Anglo-Irish Treaty, were to bring about the Free State between 1921 and 1922.
I'm just taking up on Christine's, the all-round pragmatist, and I think, Tommy, your initial questions in relation how well he got on with the ordinary people. Because, and in relation, it was essentially the question that I was asking earlier today, was he aligned with the Liberal Party? And he would have known as a landlord and having tenants and travelling throughout the country, the Monster meetings and you know, to Dublin and so on and so forth, the state of the nation, as it were. In the early part of the century, agriculture was doing well because of the Napoleonic Wars. It very quickly dipped strongly. In 1816, there was virtual famine. Now, it wasn't just because of that. There was other climate issues as well at the particular time. He would have known that there was famine, and I think it was 1822, 1823 period. And along with that, you had an increasing at such a fast rate the population, and particularly of the poorer section of the community. And they had to subdivide the land to continue. And that could only end in disaster. And yet, he aligned himself with the Liberals, who had a fundamental, both economic and other way, in sense of providentialism, believing not to interfere in the market, the population, Malthus's theory of population, and so on and so forth. And he was bound to have been aware, as a learned and you know, that had his foot in all sorts of pots at the time, to excuse the expression. So I find that a little bit hard, as a pragmatist, that he didn't see what was coming, and coming to his own people, the poorest of the poor. Thank you.
Yeah, Christine, if I pitch that one to you, because I was going to throw it in earlier, right? There was a kind of an irony that when the famine came along, he might have been better putting his money on Peel, who had a more interventionist approach, whereas his former allies under Lord John Russell, when they came in, were the worst possible government Ireland could ever have imagined in terms of the conditions at the time.
Yeah, and again, I think you're using Patrick's phrase, we know that retrospectively. Nobody knew that at the time. So O'Connell wasn't always in alliance with the Whigs. He was, I think, 1835. He was flirting with them again in 1846 on the grounds that the Tories were a worse option. So Peel did intervene, and again, retrospectively, we know that very few people died the first year of the famine. At that time, it was not called a famine. We know that when Russell came in, the policies he introduced turned out, again, we know retrospectively, to be disastrous. But in all fairness, O'Connell did believe that the Tories would be worse. Peel said himself that he would not have continued, that if he had remained in power, he would not have done any more than Russell did. So he has said that. He repealed the Corn Laws. But again, I think people think, oh, that was great. You know, it really helped corn come into Ireland. No, it didn't. It was a gradual process. So that the repeal, so-called, was a three-year process. So it didn't bring any more corn into Ireland. And the scale of the problem that Peel was dealing with was so much smaller than what Russell had to contend with. I'm not justifying that him at
just,
all.
Just very quickly, before you come in, just to very quickly explain that for anyone who doesn't know what the Corn Laws were, tariffs are in the news at the moment, right? The point is, like, massive tariffs were placed on grain from outside the United Kingdom, which essentially gave Ireland exclusive supply of the market. So on the one hand, the repeal of the Corn Laws was presented as a progressive measure to allow cheaper grain to come into Ireland. What you were saying, Christine, that didn't.
It
took several years for that to come out in the wash, as it were, right? Absolutely. I want to move on to the question of how O'Connell was perceived outside Ireland, right? David, maybe if I bring you in on this one. I mean, in Britain, for example, I mean, was he the kneecap of his day, right?
Yeah, it's a great question, sorry, yeah. Certainly he aroused some reactions in Britain. I had a look at the press, particularly looking at what the Times of England and the Belfast Newsletter wrote in relation to O'Connell and his politics. So first and foremost, one quickly forms the impression that what newspapers and periodicals such as these did was to turn some of the political methods used by O'Connell upside down. One of the things that O'Connell can be credited with was the introduction of the Catholic rent in 1824. The notion that by paying as little as one penny per month, you could become an associate of the Catholic Association, which was great at expanding membership of the association and ultimately bringing people who had nothing to do with politics, who believed that politics would never make any difference to improve their hopeless position, into constitutional politics. Well, the British press reacted to that by weaponizing it and by suggesting that O'Connell was essentially a greedy man and that he was embezzling some of the money. So the Times of England did not quite hesitate to refer to repeal not as a movement, but rather as a mercenary agitation. The Belfast Newsletter once published a virulent article where they said, south of the Shannon, roam at large men bearing huge wallets, Daniel O'Connell and his popish priests. That's the kind of rhetoric that they used. And essentially, one thing that newspapers such as these did was to see themselves as entrusted with a crucial fact-finding mission. Let's uncover the truth behind the repeal. What is repeal really? Well, at least from their point of view, of course. And they suggested that repeal was a scheme, a sophisticated scheme, a Catholic ruse to ultimately seize the lands of the aristocracy, to confiscate property from the Protestant ascendancy. And they became more aggressive in the aftermath to the proclamation, as a result of which the prospective monster meeting at Clontarf of the 8th of October 1843 was ultimately cancelled. Cancelling Clontarf essentially left O'Connell more vulnerable. It exposed him to a number of criticisms, and the criticism that he was unable to withstand pressure from the Dublin Castle, or let alone the British government itself. The criticism that he would back down whilst in the eye of the storm. They became more aggressive by suggesting that there was a very large amount of inconsistency in repeal as an ideology. Inconsistency, first and foremost, between the supposed long-term objectives of repeal and the vulnerable position in which O'Connell appeared to find himself. And secondly, inconsistency between O'Connell's magniloquent boasts that he had repeal within easy reach, and again, his rather passive attitude as a result of what happened in Clontarf. And more than anything else, inconsistency between the abandonment, temporary though it might have been, of the repeal cause and an ongoing flow of money into O'Connell's pockets. And ultimately, to cut a long story short, what these newspapers and periodicals suggested was that repeal, yes, was an agitation orchestrated and fomented by a greedy leader, followed by people who were foolish enough to believe him, people who were often denounced in the British press as credulous, people who would be duped by O'Connell into believing all sorts of things and pledging themselves to a fully incoherent ideology. And so they really upped the game by suggesting that repeal was incompatible with public safety, dangerous, against the law, and the tipping point of this was when they described repealers approaching the setting of repeal meeting as arriving in their thousands on horseback, and they were arranged in military order. Now, a lot of this was preposterous, of course, but the implicit suggestion was that O'Connell was ultimately assembling his own army. So, in terms of the framing of this, from a press point of view, the suggestion was that there was a danger to repeal, that repeal was a threat to the constitutional integrity of the Union, and as such, the government should not hesitate to crush it. And to just finish off on this, Tommy, well, the kneecap of their day, well, I recently heard, I think it was a manager of kneecap talking to Miriam O'Callaghan on primetime, and he was saying, well, as a result of what we read in the press, rather than debating what's happening in the Middle East, we're debating kneecap. Well, one would say that rather than, you know, debating repeal and why repeal was necessary, they were debating O'Connell and attacking him personally.
I'll just give you a quote here. Now, this goes back to the 1829 Clare lecture. This is Peel to Walter Scott. And he said, quote, "We were watching the movements of tens of thousands of disciplined fanatics, abstaining from every excess and every indulgence, and concentrating every passion and feeling on one single object." So the thing is, the one thing worse than a drunken Irish rabble was a sober Irish rabble, right? So, you know, I mean, Pat, do you want to comment on that? I mean, they must have hated him in the establishment.
They were definitely terrified, and that goes back even to that Clare by-election when O'Connell sent out the order in 1828. There was to be no drinking of alcohol for the 3 weeks of the campaign. There was to be no violence. And Robert Peel, the Home Secretary, was so terrified of that. He said that British power in Ireland had been shivered to atoms, because if O'Connell was able to control them with that, he could control them if he order them to rise up in rebellion. So they're always, even though O'Connell said he would never call on the people to fight, they didn't trust him, they didn't believe him. So like there was always that threat at the background of it.
And of course the great slogan of Father Matthew's temperance movement was Ireland sober is Ireland free.
Just in terms of views of him from abroad, I think I remember hearing Patrick perhaps many years ago talk about a novel of Jules Verne when it was translated into English. Yeah. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
If you just explain that to the audience.
Yeah, like John Berry spoke about at the law session yesterday as well, that Jules Verne's great novel with Captain Nemo and the Nautilus, the submarine, and Captain Nemo in his stateroom has the portraits of all of the great figures, and there you have Abraham Lincoln, and but you have Daniel O'Connell as the defender of his people. But when it was translated into English, Daniel O'Connell was left out of the Pantheon. And in fact, I could only find a version from, I think, 2010, where O'Connell was put back in.
Now, I wanted to look again, just come back to his profile in Britain, right? I mean, there were other radical movements in Britain itself, David. I mean, so what was his relationship with the Chartists? And maybe, Christine, if you want to come in on this as well. I mean, my vague memory of this is that he supported them when they were weak, but he didn't support them when they were strong, right? You know, so he didn't support them when it might have made a difference. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, I would probably use the adjective ambivalent to describe the relationship between the repeal movement and the Chartist movement. The Chartist movement had been largely driven by the working classes and developing out of dissatisfaction with the failure of the Reform Act of 1832 to extend the right to vote to people who did not own property. There are, I think, a number of similarities between the two movements. The Chartists, at least some of the Chartists, were known to be supporters of the repeal cause. O'Connell was reported to have been involved in the discussions that led to the People's Charter, a key document of the Chartist movement being drafted in 1838. There was a commitment to democracy on the part of both movements, and both movements appear to have emerged from a very rich tradition of popular politics dating back to the 1780s and 1790s. And what did the Chartists do? Well, they petitioned the House of Commons on a number of occasions. They did so in 1839, and I mean, they had collected no less than 1 million signatures. They did so again in 1842. They collected no less than 3 million signatures. And then again in 1848. And, well, what did the repeal do? Well, a key idea of repeal was to petition the British monarchy in order to secure concessions for Ireland. So there is a number of similarities, but assessing the frictions between the two movements, Matthew Roberts, writing for the Journal of Modern History a few years ago, explains why. If you read through the documents of the Chartists in Leicester or in Hull, some venomous language is used to refer to O'Connell. Some of them refer to O'Connell as a political apostate, as a vile man, as a traitor. So why all the venom? Where was it from? Well, essentially, he suggests that there might also, among other things, have been an element of personal rivalry between the two O's, O'Connell in Ireland and O'Connor, Fergus O'Connor, a prominent member of the Chartist movement, the editor of the Northern Star, a Chartist newspaper. But more than anything else, it appears that there were racist and imperialist elements within the Chartist movement as well. And O'Connor certainly had no sympathy whatsoever for them. And more than anything else, O'Connor, I'm not too much of an expert on this, but apparently, again, Matthew Roberts says...
Just by the way, he's a nephew of Arthur O'Connor, who was one of the leading United Irishmen in the 1790s.
Oh, well. Yeah. And apparently he was connected to a number of radical groups that didn't quite rule out the use of violence to bring about political reform, something that O'Connell had a very different kind of relationship with.
Yeah. Now, I want to just go to... Oh, yeah, just, David, what about the rest of Europe, right? I know that Marx had a bit to say about Daniel O'Connell. Usually critical, but I always get the impression it's kind of envious. I mean, I think I just... Again, it's a vague memory that he referred to some monster meeting where Daniel O'Connell has mobilised, you know, 500,000 people. I mean, give me 500,000 people and I'd liberate the world, or words to that effect, right? So how was he perceived on continental Europe?
Well, O'Connell was extremely popular in countries like France, Germany, and even in Italy, my home country. Yes, I'll say something about this as well. In French liberal circles, many people entertained the view that O'Connell was living proof that liberal ideals and Catholic teaching were not incompatible. One of the most influential publications in French liberal circles was L'Avenir, a journal established by philosopher and theologian Robert de Lamennais, and a journal who showed much sympathy to the Catholic cause in Belgium, in Poland, and in Ireland. And the years between 1830 and 1845 were years where not one, but two organizations were established in France. The first was known as the Agence Générale pour la Liberté Religieuse, the General Agency for Religious Freedom. And the second was the Comité pour la Liberté Religieuse, the Committee for Religious Freedom. Now, these two organizations had a common denominator. They believed that O'Connell's organizational skills should be replicated in France as well. And they were passionate about the methods O'Connell used to mobilize, to influence, and so to engage public opinion in Ireland. Now, things were different in Germany. In Germany, suffice it to think that by 1848, an organization was active, alive and well and kicking. It's called the Katholischer Verein Deutschlands, the Catholic Union of Germany. Now, they were organized along the very same lines as the Catholic Association in Ireland. And O'Connell appeared to be extremely popular in both academic and non-academic circles. From an academic point of view, I can think of one example, Professor Franz Josef Ritter von Buss, who taught political science and law at the University of Freiburg. He professed to be an admirer of O'Connell, and he said that he owed it to O'Connell that he had formed very strong views as to the role of Catholics in German society. He believed that political representation for Catholics should be strengthened. He believed that the position of the Catholic Church should be consolidated vis-a-vis the state. And he believed that a Catholic press should be established in order to counter the influence of the predominantly secular and anti-Catholic liberal press that circulated in some parts of Germany. And as far as non-academic circles are concerned, there were parts of Germany, particularly Munich, Baden, and the Rhineland, more than any other area, where O'Connell was regarded as a national folk hero. Apparently, his portrait hung in many taverns and in many homes. Apparently, the sale itself of his portrait was advertised by the non-Catholic press as well. Now, Italy is not such a strong example, but I like to think of a figure, Catholic priest and Catholic liberal, Father Gioacchino Ventura, the man that delivered the funeral oration in memory of O'Connell at the Church of Sant'Andrea della Valle in Rome. And he said that O'Connell proved that it was possible to reunite ideals that the French revolutionaries had kept apart, true religion and true liberty. And he said that O'Connell proved that so much could be achieved without resorting to violence, but rather through methods such as passive resistance, active obedience, and in general, by conducting your own political struggles within the limits set by the law. And truth be told, the Christian Democratic Party, which no longer exists in Italy, but it's the party that ruled Italy from the second post-World War period until the early 1990s, okay, the founders of the party looked to O'Connell as a precursor. So very strong influence across Europe, I should say.
Now, Jennifer, I just want to move back to his profile in the United States, because David said a bit about this already, right? And in particular, his relationship with Frederick Douglass, the famous black abolitionist. And of course, O'Connell invited Douglass to speak in Ireland. So you see the plaque on the outside the Irish Film Institute in Eustace Street. Just to talk to us then about his relationship with Frederick Douglass.
I think the resident expert on this actually is Christine, but I'm happy to go back and forth a little bit. But Christine has just extraordinary scholarship in this area, so perhaps we start there and then I can tack on.
Okay, the floor is yours, Christine.
So Frederick Douglass wasn't invited by O'Connell. Yeah. He certainly knew of O'Connell. He'd heard about a duel that the American ambassador to London in 1838 had been insulted by O'Connell and wanted to duel him, and he said, I heard in the curses of my master this man's name, and I knew if they hated him I should love him. Mm-hmm. And he talked about when he came to Ireland. He initially came if you don't know, Frederick Douglass, he was an escaped slave. He escaped when he was 20 years old, self-emancipated, self-educated. He attended abolitionist meetings. At one meeting, he was heard by the white abolitionist Garrison, William Garrison, who invited him to become a lecturer for the American Anti-Slavery Society. And Frederick Douglass had taught himself how to make public speeches, how to frame an argument. He was very thoughtful about this. And he was a brilliant orator. But people doubted that he had ever been enslaved, that he was self-taught. And so he wrote his narrative in 1845. And he wasn't the first person to write a life story, the first slave, but he was the most popular. It became a bestseller. But that propelled him into a position where he was in danger of being captured and returned into enslavement. So Garrison and others said, you need to leave America. He didn't want to. He was 27 years old, married with four young children. But he did. He agreed. And for Garrison, he wanted to build a transatlantic movement. So he very clearly knew why he was sending his superstar abroad. So Frederick Douglass arrived in Liverpool, August 1845. He was with a white abolitionist. They stayed in a temperance hotel. Frederick Douglass, unlike O'Connell, was into temperance for two nights. And then Frederick Douglass came to Ireland. He initially came for a few days. He was to stay at the home on what is now Pierce Street of a Dublin printer Quaker, Richard Davis Webb. And Webb had agreed to reprint the narrative to give Frederick Douglass money to live on when he was abroad. The narrative, if any of you read it, the preface actually quotes O'Connell. So again, a very strong link even before Frederick Douglass comes to Ireland. Frederick Douglass is invited to speak at an anti-slavery meeting, 3rd of September 1845. It's in City Hall. And he talks about how poignant that date is because it's the anniversary of him escaping from being a slave, 7th anniversary. The City Hall is full, and so they say, we'll do another one. So he moves to Eustace Street, where the plaque is, and he ends up giving a number of lectures in Dublin, each one bigger than the other.
Now, he was introduced by O'Connell as the Black O'Connell.
No, he wasn't.
What, no, okay, so another misquote there. Okay, let the record show. He never,
okay.
Because that's the received version.
It's the received, and it's because Frederick Douglass said that.
Right.
But he said it retrospectively, and memory is not always a great thing. So anyway, he...
So Frederick Douglass described himself.
Yes.
Okay,
he said,
it's a bit like just because you're born a stable doesn't mean you're a horse, which... As Wellington is accused of saying, it was actually O'Connell said it anyway.
That's right.
Move on.
He was a great admirer. He actually spotted O'Connell in the street. O'Connell was just back from Derrynane, and he saw him interacting with some street urchins and was absolutely charmed by it and said, this man inspires even the poorest of children. So it's a very beautiful quote. But 29th of September 1845, Frederick Douglass attended a repeal meeting, Conciliation Hall, which replaced where they'd met previously. 3,000 people were there. Douglass arrived late. He was at the back, but he heard O'Connell speak, and O'Connell spoke about slavery. And later that night, Douglass wrote to Garrison saying, this man, his power over an audience is perfect. Again, he was entranced by hearing his hero speak. When O'Connell sat down, the hall started to empty out. Douglass moved to the front. John O'Connell said, you must meet my father. And Fred Douglas was invited on stage by Daniel O'Connell. So this man in his 70s, this great leader, invited this self-educated 27-year-old former slave onto stage to speak. And Frederick Douglass started off, he was very funny, he was very humble, but during the course of his speech he said, "What my people need is a black O'Connell." And then he pretty well ended his speech by borrowing a phrase from O'Connell, which was, "Agitate, agitate, agitate." And that was a phrase he made his own. Douglass went on to write two more autobiographies, and in one of them he talked very fondly, the second one, the third one, of meeting O'Connell, and he said, "You know, this great man called me the Black O'Connell." But if you go to the newspapers of the day, okay, it didn't quite happen that way. But clearly, they never met again. They didn't correspond, they were not friends, but O'Connell's influence on Frederick Douglass was immense, and he quoted him throughout his life. And later on, Douglass became a Home Rule supporter and spoke in Washington in defence of Home Rule.
Now, just before we move on from the slavery and abolitionist question, one of the things, one of his great legacies, O'Connell's great legacies, is that he insisted, when slavery was abolished and people were compensated, that the names of the people compensated and the amount of money they were paid should be noted, and that is now available online, and it makes for very embarrassing reading for certain elements in British ruling circles, right? That Gladstone's antecedents, apparently, Tony Benn's, the Wedgwood Benn's, I think. Anyway, there's a whole list of them. And the point is, we can put it to Daniel O'Connell as a person who insisted that be made public, and it's been used, of course, by historians today. Listen, just before we finish up, Patrick, I want to go to you now, because you had a series of monster meetings, right? And then there was a monster meeting organised for Clontarf, which was banned by the government, who threatened to send in the army to disperse it, and O'Connell backed down. So did he bottle it, basically?
But even I think the way you frame it there, in a way, I suppose challenge the way you framed the question. Did he bottle it? He backed down. You know, he wouldn't have definitely seen it in those terms. You know, I think, unfortunately, that's framed in the way Daniel O'Connell, I think, has been damaged in Irish history. He's seen as having failed the Irish people there. If he had gone ahead, it would have been Ireland's 1916 moment. It would have kick-started a revolution. But there was no guarantee of that. It would certainly have been a massacre. It would have led to thousands of people being killed. O'Connell himself would have been killed because he would have led them in. And then who would have taken over the movement then when the country would have risen up in this rebellion? They had no weapons. They weren't prepared for it. The British would have just sent in the army, and it would have been just a massacre across the country. But the way you've criticised is how revolutionaries and radicals have criticised him over. But I think that thinking has damaged O'Connell more than anything else. And I think it is lazy thinking. I think it's the problem that people see it from this blinkers of the revolutionary struggle through the decade of centenaries in 1916. And O'Connell was putting the interests of the Irish people first. He was saving lives. He wasn't going to authorise a bloodbath. And the people in Young Ireland backed him at the time and then subsequently denied having backed him, which showed their cowardice. And they were, you know, bunch of slave apologists and a very narrow nationalist. Thomas Davis going on about how great the Irish language would be, performing a natural barrier between Ireland and Britain, when he had no Irish entirely at all. Whereas Daniel O'Connell, who is fluent in Irish, is somehow unfairly criticised for being an enemy of the Irish language, which again shows the lazy thinking around O'Connell. So I think the problem with the question is it really doesn't capture the reality of 1843. It's applying a retrospective approach to it, and in a way, it's part of the problem that O'Connell's reputation has suffered from.
I'd say it's a pretty common question people would ask, though, Patrick, if you don't mind me saying so. I mean, it's the kind of question most people would ask in terms of knowledge of O'Connell, right? Because the point is, I take your point, right? But the point is, it's all downhill after this. And the thing is, even though he called off the meeting, he was still prosecuted for sedition and jailed. In other words, he paid the price. And it also...
I suppose if I was to ask you, Do you think Daniel O'Connell bottled it at Clontarf? Your opinion?
I don't know. I'm not an expert in the period.
But I bet you have an opinion.
No. I have to say that...
You genuinely have no opinion?
I think the problem is that it exposes the reality of power in Ireland. That at the end of the day, the British were prepared to threaten, not just threaten, but to use violence. This is the thing, you see. And I think one of the problems, which, if you don't mind me saying so, your response demonstrates, is the assumption that Irish nationalism is in two parallel streams, you know, no, constitutional nationalism on one side,
That's the exact opposite of what I believe. Yeah. I don't believe they're two, but I believe they are two.
Let me finish the point, Patrick, right? In my old age, right, I developed a more nuanced position that what Irish nationalism operates across a spectrum. Revolution nationalism on one end, constitution nationalism on the other. And in between is public opinion swinging like a pendulum. And the whole thing shifts depending on the circumstances. But the point is, Clontarf meeting, what it demonstrated was the limits of peaceful agitation. And it also exposed the lengths to which the British establishment were going to go to defend their position. I mean, they were even prepared to massacre their own citizens like they did at, say, Peterloo. You know, so I think it's a legitimate question.
Well, no, it's the way you phrased it, but I don't think the way you framed it there is even right, that it showed the limits of peace reform. The repeal movements had made mistakes in the way they advertised the meeting. John Mitchell had arranged the notice, and he used language that wasn't legally precise, and it gave an opening to the British government to cancel it within the realms of the law. So in a way, that's still working within the law, and O'Connell was the patriot working within the law. So I don't think it's as clear cut as that, but I think that for generations of people who have grown up worshipping Patrick Pearse in 1916, they see O'Connell as a traitor and a coward for that, whereas I think O'Connell showed the greatest courage in 1843 in cancelling that meeting. And until Irish people come to terms with Clontarf, then I don't really think we'll have come to terms with our own history.
Anybody else, the panel, want to come in on this?
Yeah, don't think it was downhill all the way. Shortly after Clontarf, O'Connell penned a letter, 10-page letter, absolutely searing and brilliant, to Irish Americans, berating them for supporting slavery. And I think that's one of his greatest achievements as an abolitionist. He met Frederick Douglass 2 years later, again, another great achievement. So I don't think it was all downhill after Clontarf.
I think
question here. So, yeah, Jennifer, you want to come in first, and I'll go to...
I was just going to say the legacies are so incredibly important, because if we're thinking about a figure like Douglass and the extended reach of Douglass's work in the suffrage movement, continued conversations on categories of personhood as well as citizenship, Catholic emancipation allowed a figure like Douglass to imagine his own emancipation and his own prospect of citizenship. And the long-term effects of thinking about the ways in which a parliamentarian like O'Connell, a barrister like O'Connell, can not only work within the parameters of the law, but also put forward the prospect of legislation that continues to change the law. That evolution, I think, is critical, and it's a version of revolution that is part of the inheritance of what we see at the turn of the 20th century. I don't think Pearse could have conjured up many of his concepts had it not been the legacies provided by an individual thinking both within the constraints of the particular moment as well as imagining an alternative political future without a figure like O'Connell.
Gentlemen here, yeah.
Professor Keneally has actually touched on the very question I was going to ask, which is, what did the Irish Americans think of O'Connell in the 19th century, in the 20th century, and what do they think of him today?
He polarised opinion. For some, he was kneecap, that's definite. For others, he was an absolute hero. And he had a lot of support from Irish Americans for repeal, both Protestants and Catholics. But when he became such a champion of abolition, people were very uncomfortable. Irish Americans, I think we alluded to it, for many reasons, they didn't support abolition. Even the Catholic Church hierarchy, John Hughes, the first Bishop of New York, he really hated the abolitionists. He said they believe in women's rights, they believe in animal rights, they're temperance men and they're Protestant bigots. Don't support them. He later changed his position. He also felt Irish coming in, I think David said this, Irish coming into America were vulnerable and they were told if slaves are liberated, they're going to be competition for jobs, etc. Slavery, people argued, was in the Constitution. It wasn't directly. But for all sort of complicated reasons, Irish Americans were told not to get involved in the issue. For Daniel O'Connell, who was in Ireland, refused to go to America. He was much more dogmatic, and he believed that Irish Americans, whatever the cost, should speak out against slavery. Marianne McCracken, later on, she took the same position. So, but Irish Americans do not have a great track record in America. And Frederick Douglass said, why is it that Irish people are such ardent abolitionists in Ireland, yet they sail the Atlantic and they change? And that really confused him and perplexed him.
Now, before any other questions before we wrap up, I just want to throw a final one in here. O'Connell dies in 1847, right? One of the things that always puzzled me is that, I mean, he's often credited with being the creator of Irish democracy. I mean, I'm quoting here from Oliver McDonough, he was perhaps the greatest innovator in modern democratic politics, as well as the originator of almost all the basic strategies of modern Anglo-Irish constitutional relations. That being said then, how come he didn't leave any political machine or party behind him? Patrick.
Well, he did leave a huge legacy. He argued against Isaac Butt at one of these debates on the future of Ireland. And at the end of a very heated exchange, Daniel O'Connell's friends were all criticising Butt. And O'Connell said, no, I was watching him. He will be a friend of our cause. So you could say the great cause was taken up by Isaac Butt. It was taken up by Parnell. It was taken up by other figures in the 20th century. And it continues today. And I suppose for us in the 21st century, you know, we're heading into an Irish presidential election. It is interesting and revealing that some political parties are completely silent when it comes to Daniel O'Connell. Some political parties refuse to say anything. And I think they're on the side that he bottled it at Clontarf. And I don't think parties that are unable to come to terms with the legacy of O'Connell, I don't think they deserve to be in power. I don't think they are equipped to be in power. And I don't think they're ready to be in power. And I think if we talk about our maturity as a nation, I think some political parties also have further to go on the road.
But what I'm saying in that question is, like, I mean, is, you know, I have the greatest respect for Daniel O'Connell, by the way, Patrick, just to say this, right? But the thing is, like, given that it took like another generation before a similar movement revived, basically the Parnell's parliamentary party, 1870s, 1880s, you know? So the thing is, like, was it all just a personality cult? That's the thing. Like, was it all about O'Connell's personality? Was it all about him? Or did it represent a real movement, Christine?
Yeah, he died May 1847. What do we remember 1847 as? Black 47?
Yeah.
Worst year of the famine, yeah. Probably. So Ireland was fractured and it didn't recover. So I think part of that recovery process was it was the dislocation of people. I just don't think it was really possible to build a strong party in the late 1840s or 1850s.
Yeah, there was a collapse of dislocation at the time, so, but isn't that why we then got the IRB in 1858 and so on? And
yeah.
And well, that's the old pendulum swing, and go back to my metaphor earlier.
As I have the microphone, before you wrap up, Tommy, could you ask later, is there a case, a lot of people believe that he was the greatest Irish person that ever lived. So you might ask the show of hands from the audience later on when you wrap up.
I'll abstain from that vote as the chairperson here. No, I tell you, I'll leave that suggestion, right? this is a very lively discussion, actually. Just
what I like.
Yes. Oh, yes. Listen, one last question there. Yeah.
Did he say that the Irish language was the badge of a defeated race?
I'm not familiar with that. But like, he loved the Irish language. He was fluent in Irish. He regretted not changing his surname to O'Connell after emancipation because he thought the other was an English imposition. But he is blamed for a statement he made where he saw English as the language of the future because of it being the language in the United States and England all around, and he made a comment. But he is blamed by some for the destruction of the Irish language. But, you know, he died in 1847. He didn't devise the school education curriculum on the Irish language. He didn't put PEG on the curriculum. He didn't insist it was taught in a particular way. And I think people have used him as an excuse to mask their own failings when it comes to the Irish language. Whereas no one loved the Irish language more than O'Connell. And again, I think that that also shows a sad lack of awareness about what O'Connell really thought about some of these crucial issues.
Well, we're going to be fleshing all this out over the next period, Patrick. You know, in headshoes like this and in the pages of History of Ireland and so on. I'm just going to wrap things up here. First of all, I'd like to thank Glasnevin Cemetery for hosting us here. I'd like to thank Keith on sound. I'd like to thank you, the audience, for turning up, particularly those people who made contributions from the floor. Our next History Ireland Head School will be at the Electric Picnic on the 30th of August. Now, if you don't have tickets, don't worry, because it will be recorded and posted as a podcast. And the topic will be Where Stands Dev 50 Years On? That'll be another quiet one, I presume. So I'd just like to thank our panel, Patrick Gagan, Jennifer Keating, Christine Keneally, and David Matzi. Thank you very much.